Hello, and welcome to Radio New Internationalist. Each week in this program, New Internationalists from around the world explore the people, the ideas, and the action in the fight for global justice. In a moment, campaigners from Africa, Burma, India, and New Zealand will start dropping in. They'll be bringing us stories and experiences about some inspirational women doing some inspirational things. Women stopping company takeovers of the food chain, women fighting the use of rape as a weapon of war, and women claiming their place in political space. I'm Chris Richards from New Internationalist magazine. In the last century, women's rights have run a marathon. Across the globe, women have been fighting and winning the right to slam their stove doors shut and put down their mops, to participate more equally in government, in education, in paid work, and all the other wonderful things that a good life offers. Last week, we heard why some women haven't got there yet. This week, we're experiencing what happens when they arrive. Right now, Rachel Maher and I are going through the Radio New Internationalist archives and revisiting some of the powerful and passionate voices we've been hearing on this program this year. And we've found that it's the women who've really starred. They're an inspirational bunch, vivacious, outspoken, interesting, warm, funny, stepping out bravely to create more inclusive communities and building a better world. For instance, India's environmentalist extraordinaire Vandana Shiva. I spoke with Vandana about a whole range of issues in March. I'll get out her interview now to replay it for you so you can get what I mean. As a world-renowned scientist based in northern India, she's an amazing advocate protecting food supplies. She's set up a remarkable legacy to humanity, a seed bank to protect biodiversity through Navdanya, a movement that she set up in 1991 to counter corporate control of the food chain. Navdanya has worked with 300,000 Indian farmers. I asked Vandana in what way her work has helped them. Here's what she said.
When I started Navdanya, which means nine seeds, and it can also mean the new gift, it was basically to have an alternative to the emerging monopolies of the giant corporations who were taking over biotechnology, the seed companies. These were the old chemical giants like Monsanto, like Syngenta, and the idea that all seed and all life on the earth would be patented and genetically manipulated by them was so abhorrent to me, given that I spent all my life defending the diversity of plants and trees and crops. So I thought I'd start creating community seed banks so that farmers could not be criminalized for saving and sharing seeds, because patents on seed, intellectual property rights on seed, in effect says a farmer saving seed is a thief. A farmer sharing seed with a neighbor is a thief. And I could not accept this immoral order. Took inspiration from Gandhi, who disobeyed the salt laws of the British and said, nature gives it for free. We will continue to make the salt for our survival and our needs. We will disobey our salt laws. And that is the spirit with which I started Navdanya. We've set up more than 35 community seed banks across the country. And in any place where Navdanya has worked, not a single suicide has taken place, because when farmers have their own seeds and do organic farming, there's no question of them getting into debt and committing suicide.
We should say that 200,000 farmers have committed suicide as a result of biotech in the cotton industry in particular. Is that right, Vandana?
Yes. If you make a map of the suicides, it has a one-to-one correspondence with the cotton belt, and increasingly the cotton belt is becoming a BT cotton belt. BT is a genetically engineered cotton that Monsanto monopolizes. It has licensing arrangements with many companies. So you might think a Mahiko is different from a Nath, is different from a Rallis, but ultimately they're all licensees of Monsanto. Vidarbha in Maharashtra is the worst hit. The acreage of BT has shot up to 2.8 million acres. One farmer is committing suicide every 6 hours in Vidarbha now.
Wow.
And Navdanya has started a campaign called Seeds of Hope, where we are distributing seeds to farmers, asking them to give up BT cotton because they have no other seed. They keep buying BT cotton because Monsanto has ensured there's a seed famine. Today, I will leave for a very historic place called Champaran, from where Gandhi started another satyagraha, another civil disobedience movement against the compulsory planting of indigo. Indigo used to be the blue dye, and Indian peasants could not grow food for themselves. They had to grow indigo for the British textile industry. I will start a two-week seed pilgrimage with my colleagues and farmers through 8 states of India. We will be distributing seeds. We will be saving seeds on the journey. And I believe as long as farmers have their own seed, they have not just seed freedom, but they have their food freedom and they have their food sovereignty. So we are bringing them seeds of food crops. We are bringing them seeds of non-BT cotton. And this is something your listeners could join no matter where they are. Join the campaign of Seeds of Hope. Contribute to helping farmers grow organic food, grow organic cotton, and through that, get out of the suicide trap. This movement for creating hope through GMO-free villages is a very, very important part of Navdanya's work.
So how deep is genetic modification reaching into the crops of India at the moment then, Vandana?
The genetically engineered BT cotton is the only crop that's grown on any commercial scale in India. They are trying to get into vegetables, but so far our movements and legal cases have prevented that from happening.
Vandana, we've been talking about a number of science-led threats to the food supply chain, genetic engineering, nanotechnology. Looking into your crystal ball, what's next on the horizon, do you think?
Well, I think the science horizon is going to split. There's going to be the reductionist science that's brought us the chemicals and then the genetic engineering and now nanotechnologies. And on the other side, there's going to be the holistic science that is bringing us ecological farming, good, healthy, wholesome processing, and the science of a holistic nutrition, a better integration of farming with health and the environment.
Yes.
And I believe the environmental crisis around agriculture, the food crisis, the obesity crisis, all kinds of food-related diseases are compelling humanity to step back and see whether leaving our food in the hands of corporations who bring new mysterious tools to manipulate our food and say this is high tech, therefore trust us, whether people are going to trust them or not, I think will be a big issue of food freedom. We will have food freedom or we will have food fascism with technologies being used as a way of controlling our food system. If you want to find out more about Seeds of Hope or about Navdanya, go to www.navdanya.org. That's our website, and hopefully you'll find what you need. If you don't, write to me at vandana.shiva@gmail.com.
You're an inspiration, Vandana. Thank you very much for speaking with us today, and all the best.
Bye-bye.
Isn't she just amazing? That was Vandana Shiva from Navdanya. And if you want to hear more from her, dip into Radio New Internationalist Archives and download the program called Not So Supermarkets. You're listening to Radio New Internationalist. I'm Chris Richards, and today Radio New Internationalist Associate Producer Rachel Maher and I are reviewing our radio archives, revisiting some of the most memorable interviews from this year. You know, there's so much to choose from, an amazing range of realists, rebels and radicals reaching out from all corners of the globe with new ways of thinking and bringing the big issues into our kitchens, lounge rooms and cars. The good news is that they are part of our permanent archive, more than 80 Radio New Internationalist programs on an enormous range of issues just waiting for you to download onto your computer or podcaster. All you need to do is go to Radio New Internationalist, www.newint.org, then click on Radio. The bad news is that this is one of our last programs. Yes, unfortunately, we've run out of money and we're going to have to walk away from these mics. But we've still got a few weeks to enjoy each other's company and enjoy those powerful and passionate voices that we rarely hear elsewhere. Rachel, I can see that you're smiling. So what have you found there?
Well, Chris, Jenny Williams spoke to us with great passion about the work of her organisation, WOZA, which is short for Women of Zimbabwe Arise. We heard from Jenny in January this year in the lead up to Zimbabwe's elections, and she described defiant acts of peace from the women of WOZA and confrontations with police in Zimbabwe. And certainly there have been dramatic political developments there in the past few months, especially surrounding the presidential election. And in fact, Jenny was arrested on the 28th of May during a peaceful procession and was detained for 36 days. So I think, unfortunately, Chris, probably not much has changed in terms of the situations that Jenny described back in January in terms of the violence and the intimidation of people who are defending human rights in Zimbabwe. And her stories can really give us some idea about what's happening now, day to day.
Article 21 of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights says everyone has the right to take part in the government of his country. Yet the closest that most of us get to this is a ballot box once every 3 or 4 years. But not the good women of WOZA, short for Women of Zimbabwe Arise. It's urging Zimbabwe's women to come forward and very vocally put their views. Its national coordinator is Jenny Williams. Why was WOZA formed, Jenny?
Well, it was formed precisely, as you mentioned in the introduction, is to give women a platform to speak out about the issues of governance, about everyday issues in their lives. But it was also formed at a time when there was a raft of repressive legislation in Zimbabwe that had silenced any critical view of the government. And so we felt that we had to have a mandate of civil disobedience, a strategic nonviolent protest, and we had to be highly visible, being courageous in the street and speaking out about our issues that affect day-to-day life in Zimbabwe.
WOZA's conducted 50 protests in its first 3 years, and over 2,500 WOZA women spent time in police custody during those protests. You've marched on a number of authorities and on shops that aren't providing affordable food. Tell us about some of WOZA's most successful actions, Jenny.
Well, I think we've now been 5 years in operation, and I think our number of protests are probably heading over 100 protests. But I think the most memorable period that we have had has been in the last 3 months. We partnered with a research organization and we prepared an analysis of political violence suffered by our members. And we named who the perpetrators of that violence was. And in October, we launched a report outlining this violence. We then decided that we would take those reports en masse directly to the Zimbabwe Republic Police, who are the main perpetrators of violence against WOZA members in the peaceful protests. And we had demonstrations directly to 3 of the police headquarters. It has been quite profound that when you confront someone directly with their evil deeds, that they very often are too embarrassed to actually look you in the face. And we found that we never spent a night in custody, and most of us were released without being tortured that day. So it was a sign, that our direct confrontational approach hit the nail right on the head. And since then, although we haven't spent time in custody, there's been a now more underhanded way of trying to deal with us, trying to stop us from protesting. So although we haven't been arrested, we have had members abducted from their homes, and it has signaled a change in the way the police are viewing us to possibly something that is actually more evil, with abductions and threats directly on members' lives.
Jenny, that's very dangerous work. How do you get women to participate in actions when, for instance, they've never protested before?
Well, we do a lot of community meetings where we discuss issues. We do a lot of training in strategic nonviolence. We also try to look at the nature and the character of us as African women and find ways that we can, within our characteristics, the way we are, within our culture, we can find ways to hold this government accountable. We also look at our creativity and our femininity. We look at our opportunities and our weaknesses, what we're strong at, and we find ways to build all of those into the style of protest that you have seen, marching on Valentine's Day with red roses saying, it's time to learn to love again, Zimbabweans. And because we blend that femininity, that nonviolence, and that creativity, we find that we as a leadership of the organization actually are not coping enough with the demand for us to recruit new members, the demand to open up new areas. There are just not enough hours in the day for us to answer all the calls for our organization and its style of work.
Absolutely. Jenny, you were talking about your action with the police and that as a consequence some of your members are being abducted at the moment. Has the action that you've taken also divided the police force? Are you finding that some members of the police force are actually turning and actually siding with you whilst others remain entrenched in their current position?
Most definitely, you know, this has also been another very successful way in which we have worked because we are ordinary members who do not expect to have political office and our agenda is just everyday basic issues. We are also recognized by the Zimbabwe Republic Police, by the Central Intelligence Agency, as representing their issues that they are not free because of the uniform, because they are in the employ of the dictator Robert Mugabe. They cannot speak out about those issues. And so very often when we are in custody, we regard ourselves as being facilitators of a workshop on life and how to speak out nonviolently. And we do joke about that. We say when we're in custody that we will be conducting a workshop for police officers in how to speak out and how to hold this government accountable. And it is extremely effective. We also use a symbol in the work that we do. We hold our forefinger up and our thumb down, making the shape of an L for love. And we keep saying to police officers, we are striking you with our love. It is because of you that we do the work that we do. And so we continue to be arrested, and you can continue to be faced with the dilemma, do you just arrest us? Do you allow us to go free? Or do you beat us? Do you torture us? But it is on your conscience that you act, and you should recognize that we are representing your needs.
I'm wondering, on reflection, Jenny, do you think that nonviolent action is easier for women than it is for men? I mean, what you've just described is extraordinary, and it takes very brave people to do it. But I'm wondering whether there is some safety in being women as compared to men. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, yes, I am obviously also a gender activist, but they do say that violence is the weapon of the weak. And I think whether you are male or female, if you are weak, you will resort to violence. But I think it is a matter of enlightenment. If you put in the hands of someone the methods of strategic nonviolence to localize that their rights are God-given rights and no one can take them away, and you give them that tool to empower themselves, and then you are able to pull in solidarity from other people in the area, it strengthens someone and it makes them feel confident that strategic nonviolence is the way. You know, one of the most incredible things in our organization is the solidarity that we build. In my very first arrest in 2003, the police officers wanted to arrest me alone. And very soon there were over 100 women demanding to be arrested alongside me and saying that it
yes.
wasn't a matter of my rights, it was a matter of everyone's rights. Mm. And that is a style that has continued throughout the 5 years, where we all go and hand ourselves in, and the police just don't know how to respond to that.
Mm. That was Jenny Williams with some inspirational stories about the brave work of WOZA, Women of Zimbabwe Arise. And if you're interested in finding out more about what WOZA are doing since the election and further upheavals it has caused, head to the organisation's website, www.wozazimbabwe.org. That's www.wozazimbabwe.org. That was the Kugase Dori dub from the Ryukyu Underground CD. The largest of the Ryukyu Islands, which dot the Pacific to the south of Japan, is Okinawa, which pulses with an independent spirit, just like the amazing collection of women chatting with us here on Radio New Internationalist today. I'm Chris Richards, sitting in Community Radio Station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. Last week, we heard about one of the greatest barriers facing women in war-torn countries, the increasingly prolific use of rape and genital mutilation as a weapon of war. So we've dipped into our archives to get an interview with a remarkable young woman from Burma who's doing something about it. Charm Tong is from the Shan community, one of a number of ethnic minorities in Burma who are seeking greater autonomy but are being brutally repressed by Burma's military. We talked with Charm Tong just before Cyclone Nargis hit in early May this year, devastating Burma's Irrawaddy Delta, where some of the Shan live, and leaving 134,000 dead or missing. You may remember hearing how the military stopped international relief workers coming into the country to assist after the cyclone, a refusal that caused massive starvation and infinitely more death. When you listen to Charm Tong explain how Burma treats its ethnic minorities like the Shan, you begin to understand why.
I will give an example of the massive forced relocation program by the Burmese military regime. From 1996 to 2000, at least about 400,000 people were relocated from Shan State, from more than 1,400 villages. When the troops come into the village, they will order the head of the villager to order the civilians to move within 3 or 7 days. And anyone who found in the area can be killed and shot dead, and the Burmese military troops call it a free fire zone, where anyone who found in the area will be shot and killed, and therefore many people were executed. And during the 3 or 7 days, if people leave their belongings behind, the Burmese military just burn down all the properties that belong to the people. And in the new area, they don't provide anything. The Burmese military regime just forced them to stay in town without any support or allocate any food or place for them or shelter to the people who are forced to leave their homes where they have been staying for generations. Most of the population are Buddhist, and at least about more than 1,000 temples were destroyed, and we have documented abuse of the monks that were killed and tortured and killed and thrown in the river. That is what happened. And since 1996, forced relocation campaign that have actually driven away hundreds of thousands of the Shan from central Shan state, and until today they cannot go home. And the Shan Human Rights Foundation have documented that at least 150,000 people are now crossing the border into the neighboring countries like Thailand. However, unlike the refugees from Karen and Karenni states, the refugees from Shan state are not recognized as refugees, and therefore they have to work as the migrant workers doing all sort of manual labor, for example, construction site in the plantation, work as a domestic workers in Thailand, getting very small wages just for the survival. And they do not have any documents and can be pushed back and sent back to the hands of the Burmese military anytime.
That's an outrageously precarious existence you've just outlined. The military reaction to any notion that the Shan should be politically independent has been brutal, with villages literally being burnt off the map. The Burmese army's counterinsurgency is known as the Four Cuts. The support that they're trying to cut off Sham Thong, as I understand it, is food, funds, recruits, and information.
Yes, this is a campaign launched by the Burmese military in different ethnic areas to wipe out the population so that they can control more of the natural resources and also the people in the area. For example, the Four Cuts campaign also including to cut basic support such as food, supply, information, and also all the support that the Burmese military regime suspects that the people would give the support to the resistance. And in fact, even though the people are innocent and they did not participate in all these activities, they are still persecuted and also abused by the Burmese military regime.
I'm wondering about forced labour as well. How is that affecting people in the Shan state? Have people been forced to work when they've been taken from the villages?
Yes, like any other place in Burma, as reported by the International Labour Organization, forced labour has been used widespreadly all over Burma, and especially in the different ethnic areas. Reports have shown how the people and villagers are used as a minesweeper. They are used to carry the military supplies and weapons for the military. They also have to work for the military. For example, when the increase of the militarization and troops in different ethnic areas, first of all, the people have to build the military camp for the regime, and it's all done by the people labor. And everything is taken from the people, even the food, vegetables, and even forced people to cook, forced women to clean the base and rape them. And also, some women are forced to be porters to carry the military weapons like supplies in the daytime and rape repeatedly at night up to 4 months before they release her.
I'm just wondering, you also mentioned that rape was being used as a tool against the Shan people. How is that occurring?
Rape is officially used and condoned as a weapon of war in Shan state in the ongoing conflict. We have documented that rape has been used widespreadly and committed systematically against the women. And our report, License to Rape, show how the Burmese military commits rape with impunity. And between 1996 to 2001, we documented more than 170 cases of rape where more than 600 women and girls were raped. And also no rapists from the Burmese military troops were punished. And that whenever community or village or women reported to the local authority, most of the time the women and the family and the head of the village were also punished by the Burmese military regime. And it's also resulted in a very high number of torture
and a big number of the gang rape, up to like 30 troops. And most of the rape also commit against daughter and mother at the same time, or rape in front of the children or the family members. And high percentage of the women who are raped was killed after that, and also involved very much very brutal torture, with, for example, women sexual organs were burned alive, or girls were burned alive after being raped. And if women were raped, not only because of their gender, but it is because they are women that belong to the other ethnic group. And rape is considered as a very shameful action when it's happened to the family members. And the military regime want to use rape to humiliate and terrorize the local community and control the local community into the situation where they feel ashamed, and that to put the whole community in a very difficult and shameful situation. And also battalions that rape the women, most of them are high-ranking officers and rape in front of the ordinary soldiers, and there's no punishment against all these high-ranking officers. Therefore, it shows how rape can be used anywhere and also used to control the local population in the conflict situation like Shan State. But we know that it is not only in Shan State, but it's also happened in other ethnic areas in Burma as well. Mm. Women said that it's very difficult each time they talk about rape because it's like they are being raped again. But they want to speak out because they know that violence has been going on for a long time, and that the violence should end, and that the sexual violence should not happen to any other women in Burma.
Yes. And what are the Shan looking for, Cham Tong? What would you like to see happen in Burma?
One day, all these people, they told us, you know, that they want to return home. They want to go back. And every day we are working to support the immediate needs of the refugees, to the women and the young people, and we have been advocating for the recognition of the Shan refugees so that the UN High Commissioner for Refugees can take action and also recognize them as refugees and provide with a very, very basic support that they need, for example, food and shelter, and also allow our children to go to school and access to the education program at least. Right now we run about 14 schools along the border where we give basic education and literacy class to the children of the Shan refugees, both across the border and also along the Thai-Burma border. Shan Women's Action Network is very independent, mm-hmm. and different organizations from the Shan State Army. For us, we believe that there can be a political solution to solve like Burma's problem through the tripartite dialogue. So we are trying to advocate from the community level to international level so that pressure can be brought against the Burmese military regime for a political change in Burma.
That was Cham Tong from the Shan Women's Action Network. Cham Tong, how can the new internationalists listening today assist your organisation?
Thank you very much. We welcome all the support from our friends from the international community. To learn more about our programs and our work at our website, worldwideweb.shanwomen.org. It would be great if you can continue to raise about Burma, raise about the women of Burma and what is really happening on the ground, and that continue to expand and raise awareness among your friends, your family, no matter where you are and what job you are doing.
And that website again is www.shanwomen, all one word, S-H-A-N, shanwomen.org. Cham Tong, it was a privilege and a pleasure to talk with you. Go well, be safe, and keep up your excellent work.
Yes, thank you so much.
Yeah. You're listening to Radio New Internationalist, coming to you through radios, computers and iPods around the world, like the one you're listening to now. And if you want to hear the perspectives of any of today's guests again, or you've missed the earlier parts of this program, just jump onto your computer and visit the New Internationalist website, www.newint.org. Then click on Radio New Internationalist. I'm Chris Richards, sitting in community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia, with my friend and colleague Rachel Maher. And today we're featuring some of the world's wonder women. Amazingly brave women doing death-defying deeds against seemingly insurmountable injustices to right the world's wrongs. Inspiring stuff. Up until now, we've been focusing on women from the developing world, Rachel. What about women campaigning for a better world through rich world NGOs?
Well, Tamsin East is one of those women, Chris. She works for the World Development Movement as the Water Campaigns Officer and has been investigating the impacts of water privatisation in a country where access to clean water is a real issue for much of the population, Tanzania. Tamsin told us some startling stories about big companies spending big bucks to sell their product, but not always successfully, as in the case of British company Bywater.
Okay, let's hear it.
I think you'll see that Tanzania is one of the poorest countries in the world, and about 38% of the population do not have access to clean water. So that is the context the privatisation contract happened in Tanzania. And we've talked to many individuals on the ground. We've been told by people in Tanzania that when Bywater came in, their access to water significantly decreased and the prices for their bills came up. And when we're talking about one of the poorest countries in the world, when you see prices for water double, in some cases treble, it's not a sustainable solution. And also, Bywater focused very much on the city of Dar es Salaam, the centre of the city, where water connections were already existing. But actually, the people of Tanzania without water need new connections, and it was never in the remit of this company to provide new connections to people, which again is evidence that water privatisation is not the solution to the global water crisis, and that there's a preconceived wisdom that a private company will come in, will sort out the problem, will invest into the country, will be more efficient, increase connections. And time and again, this is shown to be false. In fact, since the contract has expired, the company has been handed over to public hands, and there is now significant improvement to the water services.
Yes, that's an interesting paradox, isn't it? That the public water system, which the private company was sent in to cure, has actually taken over and made the situation in Dar es Salaam better. Tanzania is not an isolated case, is it? In Bolivia, Latin America, and in Mali and Gambia in Africa, water privatisers have failed to deliver clean and affordable water. So why do poor countries sign up?
There are a number of reasons why poor countries will sign up, but the main reason is a lot of these countries are some of the poorest countries in the world, and they're desperate for money to invest in their infrastructure, in their services. And countries are often put in a very difficult position where they're being urged to privatise their basic services, whether that's health, water or education, in return for debt and aid relief. And often that is too tempting to turn down. And this is exactly what we saw in Tanzania. The international financial institutions put conditions that the water supply, among I think 30 other services, had to be privatised in return for debt relief. And the UK government was also complicit in this approach, funding it with £10 million.
You've said that conditionalities were placed on loans. If privatisation is not delivering the goods, I'm wondering why institutions that lend money, institutions like the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund, are actually placing those types of conditions on the loans that they're actually making at the moment.
As I said earlier, I think there's a preconceived wisdom that private companies do perform better. But it's interesting because the International Monetary Fund commissioned its own research into the efficiency of private companies and came out saying that there was no evidence they were any more efficient than the public sector. And I think the private sector is seen as a silver bullet, that it can come in and it can fix everything and it's a very easy solution. And international institutions are keen to fund that to support the companies that often exist in their countries where the main vote holders sit. But evidence shows that we need to support public utilities. It's actually a much more difficult process. There needs to be a whole change management process. There needs to be a lot of support given. We're not saying there isn't a problem in developing countries. There is a problem, but the private companies just can't come in and solve it in a snap.
Yes. Bywater, which is the head company, has got the gall now to be countersuing the Tanzanian government for kicking them out of their contract. What's the latest there?
Well, like, this is even more worrying, as we were very pleased to see that with the earlier case, which was City Water versus the Tanzanian government, the ruling went in favour of the Tanzanian government, that services were disrupted, did decline over time. And now there's an ongoing case that's been going on for the last 2 years, which is Bywater versus the Tanzanian government. And it's for the tune of $20 to $25 million is the compensation that Bywater is seeking. And again, for us, it's another outrageous example of how we now have the situation where a company is effectively suing a developing country government when it itself failed to deliver on its water privatization contract. And no matter where the wrongs and rights are among this case, it's a very complicated case. If the Tanzanian government has to shell out $25 million, it's only the poor people of Tanzania who are going to suffer, and more profits going to go to multinational.
Indeed. I saw that the British government spent £9.5 million to develop the privatisation push in Tanzania. Some of it went to Adam Smith International to produce a pop song for £273,000, which was singing that privatisation would bring the rain. What else was the money spent on? That seems like a ridiculous thing to be spending money on in terms of a British government funding a privatisation push in Africa.
I mean, for me, this is an absolute classic example of the outrageous use that the UK government sometimes spends our aid money on. I mean, just to clarify, that was nearly £500,000 British pounds spent to produce a pop song to convince people that privatisation was the way forward. We saw the song. It was in Swahili. We translated it. It was number one for 6 weeks in Tanzania. And when you think that is aid money, that is not about finding solutions to the global water crisis. That's about a public relations campaign, about pushing privatisation, convincing, in many ways, a sceptical population that this was a solution. Just to give you some lyrics, young plants need rain. Businesses need investment. Our old industries are like dry crops, and privatisation brings the rain. When the harvest comes, there is plenty for everyone. That is what a significant proportion of our money was spent on.
I'm laughing here because they say that progressive organisations push propaganda, but I've never heard such a great push for that.
No, I know. We've managed to quiz the International Development Secretary of the UK about this, and he has admitted in public that that was not the department's finest hour. On a more serious note, we are worried about the communications elements of these contracts that come up. Often when there's a water privatisation contract, there will be a scope in that contract for public communications around the issue of privatisation. And we're very concerned, that's just a pseudonym, for public relations to promote privatisation. And even after this Tanzanian debacle, 2 years later, the Department for International Development in the UK issued a very similar water privatisation contract in Sierra Leone. And again, worryingly, it had the same communications element factored into the contract. And the World Development Movement lobbied very hard on the government, rallied many of our supporters around the country, and actually managed to get that contract amended and the communications element removed from the contract. And it's these kind of things that we need to watch out for.
Indeed. That was Tamsin East from the World Development Movement about the disastrous water privatisation program in Tanzania, Africa. When you hear stories like that, you wonder why politicians seem so keen on privatisation. That's where our next guest comes in. Lila Harray revealed all in an interview we did with her in April this year. She's a former New Zealand cabinet minister, who's now National Secretary of New Zealand's National Distribution Union. She sat in Parliament from 1996 and was a cabinet minister between 1999 and 2002. She started our chat by outlining how her fellow ministers justified the sale of public assets while she was in Parliament.
I have never seen any aspect of the public sector that would benefit from privatisation. And in fact, what we've experienced as a result of extensive privatisation in New Zealand has been a series of financial and service disasters which have had to be remedied by later governments. The privatisation program has never had public support. In fact, in the 1990s, the Labor minister who was in charge of the privatisation of telecom, Richard Preble, commented in response to a public opinion poll that showed that 99% of New Zealanders were opposed to the privatisation of telecom, that we should be very proud to have a government that was prepared to stand up to a pressure group like that.
majority of the people.
these people really
strong.
had no particular concern for public opinion and could be quite comfortable about the security of their ideological position because, of course, the privatisation process was started by a Labor government and at the time we had a first-past-the-post electoral system dominated by two parties who were never going to lose between them and could be pretty comfortable that once they'd launched this crusade, there would be nobody there to stop them. You know, naturally enough, the National Party Conservative opposition were not going to lead the campaign against it, and they were determined to continue it once they achieved office. It had very senior public service and private sector cheerleaders for the process. I mean, this is the country that was one of the first to sell its airline. We've now had to buy it back because it was on the verge of financial collapse, having made extremely poor business decisions that not only nearly bankrupted our national airline, but also completely obliterated a significant Australian airline, Ansett Australia. This is the country where the railways and the tracks and the trains were sold for very little to a group of heavily vested interest advisors to the government on the sale, who then reaped enormous windfall profits, ran down the service. The government has had to buy back the tracks and is now in the process of negotiating the repurchase of the rail services themselves from Toll, an Australian company, which was the second owner of our national railway service. We've had plenty of examples here of failed privatisations. The reason I ended up in Parliament was that we had formed a political opposition to the privatisation process. There was a breakaway from the New Zealand Labour Party in the 1980s, and at that time the Labour Party had launched a traditional privatisation program, and by traditional I mean the direct sale of existing state assets. It was justified at that time on the basis of a range of ideological arguments. The private sector was more efficient, it was more able to allocate resources without waste and so on. It was also argued for by the position financially that New Zealand was in at the time, with large government debts being given as a reason why we needed to privatise our commercial enterprises, which had been run by the government until that time. There was enormous opposition in New Zealand to that sale process that led to a deep division in the Labour Party at the time and eventually the creation of a left anti-privatisation opposition in the form of the Alliance, which I represented from 1996. By 1996, there was a less overt privatisation program underway by government. Most of the valuable commercial assets that had been owned by the people had been sold at that point. And what we began to see was the development of a more insidious process of privatisation. And there were a range of justifications for that.
You know, it's interesting what you say about that short-term benefit that governments want to make their balance sheet look good is just that, it's a short-term benefit, isn't it? What do people say about that and what is the thinking of government? Are they prepared to sell off during their term so that they look good in the short term and don't worry about the long-term future?
There's a very short-term improvement to the government's balance sheet, but it's an immediate return and it can't be repeated. And when you consider the assets that have been privatised here, there are many examples of privatisation of monopoly businesses, which have led to really the milking of New Zealand consumers who still use that infrastructure, use those assets and pay for them, but they're paying a private sector, usually overseas owner, who is repatriating profits offshore and increasing our national indebtedness. New Zealand has a current accounts deficit that is usually described as at crisis levels and currently is around 8% of GDP. Now, that deficit, the largest single part of it is made up by the transfer of profits from overseas-owned companies operating in New Zealand to their offshore investors. Of course, all the money that we send offshore has to then be replaced by overseas borrowing. And New Zealand is extremely indebted to investors from the rest of the world and lenders from the rest of the world.
Lala, I'd like to explore a little bit about the psychology of government and its approach to privatisation, the reasons that you gave for the support of privatisation, things like private enterprise being able to deliver better than the public sector, is something that is told to populations around the world, irrespective of the country, irrespective of the government. The process of privatisation has taken hold of a breathtaking array of public services that we'd normally see as the sole province of governments in areas like health, transport, education, even prisons, areas which were run for public benefit and were not supposed to be making a profit. Giving up this territory is like giving up a big chunk of the reasons why we even thought governments were important. What do governments see as their role now that privatisation has taken away administration of so many really important public services?
First of all, while we've had a very extensive privatisation process, particularly of those commercial or semi-commercial assets, telecommunications, airlines, railways and so on, we have had very successful campaigns over the years to fight the privatisation of core public services and have been fairly successful. So while the ideologues have got their hands on various aspects of our public health and education services and have certainly promoted competition with public health and education services by the private sector, we have retained and begun to rebuild in recent years a much stronger public sector for public services. I guess that the psychology of these people is something that, you know, people like me and probably many of those listening to this program find extremely difficult to connect with. The group that launched the privatisation program in the 1980s and continued it through the 90s and does it even now really traded on some legitimate discontent with the way that public services were being run, were failing to deliver quality in a number of areas. It's a complex process that is used to prepare different sorts of public sector organisations or public services for privatisation, and running them down and reducing services and not paying attention to quality is one of the methods that the privatisation brigade used to then justify the introduction of private competition with public services, contracting out or direct sale.
As a final question, Lala, the brave new world, I wonder what it is for privatisation.
Well, the real future for the private sector and the running of public services is in two major areas, and they're both less visible, less obvious and less direct, so they're much harder to fight against. One is as we have to develop new things. We have to replace roads, we have to build new infrastructure, we have to build a new school or a hospital. They're the sorts of things that bit by bit the government, instead of replacing or developing that new service or new asset in the state sector, goes into a public-private partnership or a private finance initiative and hands over the asset's development to the private sector. So over time, given that all assets eventually have to be renewed, there is a slow drift from public ownership of infrastructure to the private ownership. And that's where a lot of our fights will be had over the next few years. The second huge area that, in my view, is wrongly often overlooked in this whole debate about privatisation is those services which we didn't need before because they were the things that women did at home for nothing, which because of demographic changes, because of the change in women's labour market participation and so on, are now services that are needed to be provided in the market.
And you're talking about childcare there.
Childcare, caring for the people, cleaning, food service.
Nurturing.
That's right. Now, this has been a huge area of expansion in the market, you know, and in the sort of direct economy. But because it's happened over a period of time when governments have been privatising, rather than ask, God, there's all these kids who need looking after, or we've got an explosion of old people who have no one to care for them, how are we going to provide that service to them as a government? We've abandoned those services completely to the private sector. And that, I think, is underestimated in terms of its impact on the overall relationship between the private sector and the rest of us. You know, we've basically, by default, let the private sector marketplace take over what 50 years ago we were all doing for ourselves and for each other. And they're essential services, and they're the last areas where you actually want profits to be made, and where quality is of primary concern. So I think that's a huge issue for us. It's a real concern that our elders and our vulnerable children are being cared for profit, not through love or community or through the organised support of the state.
I'd love to talk to you about that for another half hour, actually, but time's going to go against us here, Lila. That was Lila Harray, a former New Zealand Cabinet Minister who's now National Secretary of New Zealand's National Distribution Union. Lila, you've shared with us a perspective that we don't often hear about, so thank you so much for being brave and bold. Keep up the good fight, Lila.
Good night.
Bye for now.
Bye.
And talking about privatisation, Lila's just opened the door to the theme for next week's program. The big campaigns making a bang this year. The music that we've been playing tonight comes from the Riverboat Records series in the World Music Network's wonderful collection of inspiring music from all corners of the globe. Today's CD is a collection of ambient funk from Asia, Ryukyu Underground, meaning Okinawa Island Underground. Okinawa's in the south of Japan, and this CD takes original Japanese recordings and mixes them for dance. Find out more on the World Music Network's website, www.worldmusic.net, or by visiting the New Internationalist website, www.newint.org, which is also where you'll find a copy of this program just waiting for you to download from our audio archives. That address again, www.newint.org. Radio New Internationalist is produced at 3CR in Melbourne, Australia, and distributed via satellite on the Community Radio Network. Thanks to the Community Broadcasting Foundation for their financial assistance and the Community Broadcasting Association of Australia for sending this program to a wireless near you. This program's associate producer is Rachel Maher. I'm Chris Richards. Speak with you soon.